This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the broadcast this Friday, the big business news of the week gone by, and a story out of the housing projects in Chicago about how hard economic change really can be. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 17th of August. Glad, as always, to have you with us. And leading the economic news today is the American consumer, in a good way this time, I promise. The regular consumer sentiment survey from the University of Michigan shows we're actually feeling better about things, even if the economy itself still does feel sluggish, as it does. So that is where we're going to start our weekly wrap today, with Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville in our New York bureau, and Sudeep Reddy from the Wall Street Journal in Washington in our soundproof closet in the bureau there. Hey, guys, how are you?
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Cardiff, I start with you and this feeling that it's still stuck, even though the objective numbers are getting better, right? I mean, housing's coming back, the stock market's doing fine, and yet...
And yet, I'd respond by saying that there's a difference between getting better and getting good. We're still far from having the kind of vibrant, healthy economy we wish to have. But at the same time, just a few months ago, there were some very real concerns that the U.S. might dip back into a recession. It turned out that those fears were way overblown. And yeah, things have been getting better lately. And I think there are some encouraging signs that they'll keep getting better. Doesn't mean they're going to be great anytime soon, but getting better.
Sudeep, do you actually think the fear of double-dip recession and all that stuff is gone now? Can we banish that from our lingo?
I don't know that it's really that gone, that far gone yet.
I don't know, man.
So the fundamentals of the economy still aren't that solid. In part, it's just that we've lowered our expectations so much.
Yeah.
In the U.S., we're still barely treading water when it comes to jobs. Growth is fairly anemic. And the unemployment rate isn't really moving that much. And so you can't say that we've come out of very much. At least we haven't gotten worse, which is maybe a good thing these days.
So in other words, Cardiff, you ignorant whatever, right, Cardiff?
Yeah, Sudeep sounds like he's running for president with that fundamentals of the economy line. No, I mean, like I said, things really are bad. And it's just that they're getting a little bit better. But yeah, they can still be derailed either by a policy error or by fears from Europe or anything like that.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I have been having this feeling, honestly, I have for about like 10 days, that we're going to wake up one morning and there's going to be some apocalypse in Europe that is just going to bite us right in the fanny. And you saw Angela Merkel today came back from her vacation and felt obliged to say nice things about the European economy. Sudeep, I mean, how long until Europe turns around and is the big nightmare again?
Well, everyone is waiting for the rest of Europe, not just Angela Merkel, to come back from the beach.
Then
we can talk about what else happens in Europe. The problem is that Greece and Spain and Italy are not really that any better than they were before we've taken this this hiatus. And so the problems have been festering. The European economy has been getting worse. It's been in a slow motion meltdown, and there is still a great risk that it turns into some more rapid decline as soon as we get to September, and the huge long list of events that could trigger some kind of a sell-off around the world and bring us back into this cycle of fear and doom again.
Oh, yay. So Cardiff, this long list of events, I mean, there will be, I'm sure, I actually don't know, I haven't seen the calendar, but there will be some meeting not long after Labor Day in which it will be the umpteenth meeting to save the Eurozone, right?
Correct. And I think Spain will be first on the list. There's still a lot of things to be sorted out with the banking system there. There's still a chance that they're going to ask for a full-scale European bailout. And meanwhile, we're all waiting to see what the European Central Bank's going to do. But in the meantime, it's just astonishing to me how often markets can be fooled. I mean, if it all weren't so serious, I'd think that Angela Merkel and the other policymakers there were like playing a joke on markets to see how many times they can get them to react favorably based on nothing but words.
Well, so here's the thing. If you guys were watching CNBC at any point today, which I have over my back shoulder when I'm working, they had this the thing running on the bottom that said Dow approaching 4.5-year highs. I mean, hello? Anyone? Bueller?
It's a combination of things, though, right? I mean, it's low volumes in August, and it's also a kind of reversal of the world is ending trade. So I wouldn't read too much into what's happening.
Sudeep, what do you read? Anything?
I wouldn't read too much into that either. It's you always want to be careful in trying to bring rational thought into the stock market. while all of this has been happening with nearly 5-year highs, we've seen oil prices rising,
right.
Fears about the fiscal cliff mounting, and the rest of the world, not just Europe, but in Asia, China and Japan are also showing signs of trouble. So you don't want to get too excited at this point.
All right, we got to go. Sudeep Reddy from the Wall Street Journal down in Washington, Cardiff Garcia in our bureau in New York. Thanks, guys. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Kat.
Thanks, guy.
All right. So on Wall Street this Friday, in keeping with our theme of the day, the most boring session in 7.5 years. I'll explain that later. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. In South Africa today, authorities are trying to figure out what happened at a platinum mine outside Pretoria. 34 people were killed, at least 80 injured, after police opened fire on a group of workers striking for higher wages. From Johannesburg, Gretchen Wilson explains platinum prices are the root cause of that unrest.
Many South Africans say they're traumatized by video posted on news websites showing police shooting at a crowd of striking workers. Local talk radio stations are flooded with callers weeping, grieving for the dozens of lives lost. The shooting on a hilltop at the Lonmin Marikana mine is being called a national tragedy, but it's actually part of a bigger story. The demand for South African metals, such as platinum, is driven mainly by foreign markets. Platinum is needed to make catalytic converters for cars, electrical equipment, and jewelry. But prices have been flat for the past 5 years, partly because platinum can be recycled. So mining companies here try to get by hiring temporary workers and keeping the wages of unionized workers low. Lesiba Sashoka is with the National Union of Mine Workers, which represents some workers at the Lonmin Marikana mine, but did not endorse the strike.
The average salary of a miner, the basic one is around $5,000-$6,000.
That's around $700 a month. But because the number of mining jobs is limited and competition high, workers haven't had a lot of bargaining power in negotiations with mining companies.
Because mines can go to neighboring countries and get people that are quite cheap.
In the wake of the shooting, strikers at the Lonmin Marikana mine remain defiant. Miner Makosi Mbongane told the BBC his resolve is even stronger.
We are not going to go back to work right now. They can beat us, kill us, and kick us and trample on us with their feet.
Platinum prices are higher on global markets today. But unless there is a sustained increase, low wages are likely to prevail in South Africa's mining industry. In Johannesburg, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace.
The American dream.
Millionaires, billionaires.
Class warfare.
Paycheck to paycheck.
We pay our fair share.
From our Wealth and Poverty team now, a story about economic mobility, about how where you come from can decide how far you go. 50 years ago, maybe a little bit more, some of the biggest cities in America started experimenting with public housing, government-built, affordable places to live for the urban poor. Places like Pruitt-Igoe in St. Louis, Techwood Homes in Atlanta, and the Robert Taylor Homes in Chicago. The experiment didn't go well. Violence and drugs and spiraling poverty became the hallmarks of public housing in this country. And the poor who lived there, with very few exceptions, stayed poor. Marketplace's Sylvester Monroe has his own story.
When the Robert Taylor Homes opened in 1962, Chicago Mayor Richard Daley channeled the high hopes of a new urban generation.
This project represents the future of a great city. It represents vision.
I was 11 when my mother moved us out of a rat-infested flat and into the Robert Taylor Homes. It was a big step up. New appliances, heat, and well-kept gardens. But without tending, good intentions rot.
Now it's sort of fresh, and we're standing in this field, and you smell fresh-cut grass, actually. But what you used to smell is meatpacking houses, this awful wet blanket smell of dead animals. And in the summertime, that was oppressive.
Where's the entrance to this place?
But across the street today, it's a family reunion, a picnic for people who grew up in the first building of the Robert Taylor Homes.
Yeah, this is what I'm talking about.
Hey, Tommy.
Glad you came out, man.
My old friends like to make a fuss when I come back. I got out. I moved up. There's a certain neighborhood pride that comes with that.
That's family there.
Tommy Hamilton was still a kid when I left.
To see three and four generations of families down here, it brings joy to my heart.
It's not uncommon for three or four generations to grow up in the same housing project. But with a boost from affirmative action, I graduated from a mostly white New England prep school. My ticket to Harvard, a career, economic mobility. Most black men born into poverty stay there. Some manage to climb up a step to working poor. But people like me, still the exception, even after the city bulldozed the projects.
When they tore down these buildings and the ones that got displaced, say they probably took the project mentality with them into the other neighborhoods.
My oldest friend, Steve Stewart, knows a thing or two about project mentality. He got a scholarship to prep school just like me. But the pull of the projects can be strong. Steve dropped out of Northwestern University halfway through his junior year. Now he moves from one hood to the next, gentrification hot on his heels. He likens the movement of project people to the reservation system and Native Americans.
The Indians were here at this place, and now they have to be replaced because you need their place. When you take away someone's residence and say, well, now you have to go here, you hope it's for the better, but they got the worst situations.
Steve had a chance, and he blew it. But he says no one should really be surprised.
You follow your people's footsteps. If your daddy's a lawyer, you might want to become a lawyer because you see all the law books. If he's a doctor, you might want to do that because, hey, doc comes in and lets you know this is a nice profession. This is what you want to have. But if you're poor, you're used to poverty.
His new home is in a hood called Terrortown on the far south side. Yeah, that's T-E-R-R-O-R. And despite the name, some of the neighbors are pretty friendly.
So if I look out this window, will I be amazed at what I see going past me every day?
Yeah, it erupts.
How often do you hear gunshots?
I heard gunshots yesterday.
Charles Ross goes by Slim. He's in his 30s now. And turns out, he spent his childhood in the same projects as me and Steve. But Slim says that's no reason to just give up.
I stay in this neighborhood, but Chicago is a big city, and there's opportunity all over.
Opportunity for Slim means taking the bus out of his neighborhood, 4 hours round trip sometimes, to work in a fast food place.
I don't stay in the city and say nothing for me because all the jobs are gone and that's it. If you go out and get it, it's there for you. But if you say, I'm stuck here with nothing, then that's what you're going to get.
People from the projects can tell you what nothing means. But when it comes to defining something, they get hung up.
There's a way in which, when you are born and raised in public housing, that you were denied the opportunity to realize certain aspects of life and life experience. Many of those things having to do with upward mobility of future possibilities.
Alfred Young teaches urban economic mobility at the University of Michigan. He says for young people in the projects, getting ahead is an abstract idea.
The only vision of someone who's come from their neighborhoods or neighborhoods like theirs and that has achieved success have been athletes or entertainers.
Wentworth Gardens is one of the few projects left standing in Chicago. A group of teenagers and young men are drinking beer and chilling on the curb. We asked them what they wanted to do with their lives, what they wanted to be.
I don't know.
I'm working on it. I don't really know right now.
I go to school.
Hoping for the best.
But I don't know what I'm going to do yet.
And that's the hurdle. For guys who grow up like me, like Slim, and like the young men in Wentworth Gardens, it's the ability to see that beyond the long odds of life in the hood, there's a world of possibility. In Chicago, I'm Sylvester Monroe for Marketplace.
Coming up, long-lost loves and making ends meet.
I think it is a generational moment in which we're wondering what the American dream is and what, you know, what's left for the second generation.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials rose 0.2%. Today, 25 points, 13,275 at the bell. The NASDAQ perked up almost 0.5%, 14 points, 3,076. The S&P 500 rose 0.2%, 2 points, finished at 14.18. But get this, the S&P traded in a three-point range today. That's the narrowest in 7.5 years. There's nothing going on out there, people. For the week, the Dow gained 0.5%. The NASDAQ charged up 1.8%. The S&P 500 added 0.9%. Apple hit a record high today, up about 2% to close at $648 a share. Facebook, though, another record low, fell another 4%, 1905 at the close. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.81%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. Kids from all over the country are at the White House for a steak dinner hosted by First Lady Michelle Obama. They submitted the winning recipes in a contest, the Healthy Lunchtime Challenge. 35 years ago, the Voyager 2 spacecraft left Earth for a journey through the solar system, still moving toward interstellar space. And happy birthday, Robert Plant, Led Zeppelin's vocalist, turned 64. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There's news of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac today about the terms of the bailout they got from the government as the financial crisis descended upon us. Now, instead of having to borrow more money from the Treasury just to pay back their original bailout, the two mortgage companies are simply going to have to hand over every dime of profit they make. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has the details.
The spin from the Treasury Department was that today's action will accelerate the Obama administration's planned winding down of the big mortgage guarantee firms. Fannie and Freddie won't be required to dig themselves deeper into debt just to pay back the government, and they're being ordered to shrink their mortgage holdings 4 years earlier than planned. But at Washington Center for Economic and Policy Research, Dean Baker calls it a minor adjustment and says this move really buys the administration some time.
That's not to say they're not planning to wind them down. I'm just saying the steps they've taken to date have been pretty small.
University of Maryland professor Philip Schwagel agrees.
They are taking it so slow that it's almost a new definition of slow.
The reason was made clear more than a year ago when Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner first proposed moving Fannie and Freddie out of the loan guarantee business.
We want to be careful that that process happened in a way that doesn't interfere with or impede the process of repair in the housing market.
Professor Schwagel says that's not the only reason Washington is approaching the Fannie-Freddie phase-out cautiously.
Inevitably, reform of housing finance probably means higher interest rates on mortgages, and the administration doesn't want to touch that right now.
Schwagel says that means any of the tough decisions that could raise the cost of home loans will almost certainly have to wait until well after the election. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
You can buy pretty much anything on eBay, as you know, but its new fall sales update says that as of the end of this month, you won't be able to buy the following: spells, curses, conjuring, prayers, blessings, magic potions, tarot readings, and a whole lot of other metaphysical readings and services as well. Marketplace's Eve Tro reports nobody really saw this coming.
Kara Gubbins is a pet psychic.
My business is called A Spiritual Tale.
She does 90% of her work over the phone. Until today, she didn't know people sold psychic readings on eBay, but she can see why it's problematic. Sometimes customers are let down, like if someone calls her about a lost dog.
The owner wants me to know where that pet is, what the street name is.
She may see a tree or color, but no exact address. So how could eBay buyers know what they're getting?
I don't think they could qualify it as valuable or not valuable at all.
eBay has a buyer protection policy, but any service is hard to cover. If a tarot card reader says you'll meet a tall, handsome stranger, and you don't, is the item received not as described? That's likely the reason eBay's getting out of this business, say stock analysts. No sellers I pinged on eBay got back to me. But would I hear from eBay itself?
By your deadline, it doesn't look like you're going to get a call back from them.
That's psychic Justine Kenzer. She gave me a short reading over the phone. She thinks most psychics on eBay are taking advantage of desperate people.
eBay just does not seem like the best place to go in search of answers and healing.
The thousands of metaphysical practitioners on eBay can still use Craigslist. Oh, and just before deadline, I did get an email, not a call, from eBay. It said, transactions in these categories can be difficult to verify and resolve. Not picking up much of a spiritual vibe from that. I'm Eve Trow from Marketplace.
At some point, most of us dream about making it, doing whatever it is that we always wanted to do, whether that's climbing the ladder at Goldman Sachs, writing the great American novel, or whatever. But make it or not, even the attempt can be a struggle. Jess Walter's latest novel, Beautiful Ruins, it's called, is about that dream and the struggle to get there. Characters both here and abroad in a story told over 50 years who aim high but fall short in the end. The one thing that ties them together is the movie business. Jess, it's good to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
So I don't want to start this on a downer, but this is your second book in a row. We had you on for The Financial Lives of Poets a couple of years ago. This is your second book in a row of career dreams that don't really pan out.
Are there any other kind of career dreams?
I don't know. Mine worked out all right.
Maybe it's just a novelist job. You usually are sort of courting heartbreak when you're a novelist. But I think it is a generational moment in which we're wondering what the American dream is and what's left for the second generation, this period of sort of diminishment, I think, of expectation. You know, I think the giant houses are shrinking back. You know, I feel like we might be in this period of sort of more reasonable expectations. So maybe it isn't that they're diminished, but that they were too grand at one time. Yeah. We expected to have it all in some way.
This is a book, actually, that goes back to, you know, the period when America was on the rise, 1962, and Americans abroad, and we were it, man.
Yeah, I've so drawn to that period. I drive a 1963 Lincoln Continental convertible.
Really?
Yeah.
Does it have suicide doors? Or
it has suicide doors, yeah. The only unfortunate thing is that it's painted orange right now. But it's,
all right, you got to fix that.
And it gets 9 miles to the gallon of premium with a little STP added just to keep it going. But, yeah, I love that period of time. Especially when you're writing about Hollywood, it's a period in which America is only ascendant. You know, yeah. You can't imagine anything else. And there's a great romance that period, which is why the novel begins in Italy in 1962 with this American actress.
Yeah, there is romance. There's America ascendant. There's you can see this book.
Yeah.
But let me ask you, why the movies?
I sort of had a grand sweeping view of this whole thing, and the title Beautiful Ruins refers to the characters, to the locations,
yeah,
to just about,
yeah,
everything. But it's also kind of the ruins of America and looking at what did we produce? You know, if archaeologists come along 500 years from now, it might just be our movies that they look at. This was, you know, the entertainment industry is the thing we export to the rest of the world. And so thematically, that's why. As far as characters, when you think about ambition, you think about every character in this novel is someone who tells the story of themselves. And it's a bit of self-deception. It's a bit of public relations. But they're all engaged in telling some version of themselves, which is such an American pursuit. We don't just live our lives now. We sort of narrate them on Facebook and Twitter and look at what I'm doing. Here's what I'm doing. And that seemed to me a byproduct of living our lives. If you ask an American, what does your life resemble? Without any prompting, most of them will say a movie. Hmm. That's the metaphor they'll choose, is my life is a movie. I mean, I think it's kind of our national religion without us even seeing it.
It seems to me there are two things in this world that have a unique capacity to make you unhappy, right? One,
right?
One is love.
Right.
And the other one is work.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, I think that's right. And most of the people I meet in Hollywood, it's a fascinating place, and I don't know it well. I drop in every once in a while.
he says nonchalantly.
No, yeah, yeah. When and And I meet people who really got into this business as a creative outlet. Most people I meet want to make something great. They grew up on The Godfather or Serpico or, you know, Apocalypse Now, and they want to make something great. And there's this system in place that no one seems to like. And you wonder, then, why is the system there? You know, why do all these people who want to make something great keep getting chewed up by a system that seems beyond their control?
Jess Walter. His new book is called Beautiful Ruins. We've got an excerpt on our website. It's marketplace.org/thebigbook. Jess, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
I'm not going to tell you this has been a big, heavy week for serious news, but sometimes late of a Friday, you need a break from the headlines all the same. And when that happens to us, we have our own Brendan Francis Noonan and Rico Galliano ask around a little bit about the news that didn't quite make the headlines.
Marketplace's David Brancaccio. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
A new program out of California called Californians Help Eliminate All the Evasive Registration Scoff Laws.
Catchy.
Yeah, really. Apparently, if you move to the state, you have just 20 days to register your car and pay all the fees. And if you don't, this new system allows your neighbor to rat you out. And they're trying to collect, apparently, millions of dollars in uncollected fees.
So what's with the awkward title?
It works out to be the acronym CHEATERS.
Which sounds like a bad reality TV show.
Some sort of lame sports bar.
Bridget Bodner, production assistant. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
I'm going to be talking about the playlist for NASA's Robot on Mars Curiosity. These NASA scientists have programmed various music to wake it up in the morning.
Oh. So what's on it?
Well, we've got Good Morning by the Beatles. You know, there's nothing. I went through it. I was born in 1989, and there's only one song released after I was born.
Which is?
Got the Time by Anthrax, 1990.
I don't know. You got to be careful what you're with for. You don't want Curiosity blasting Mars with Justin Bieber. That could happen.
Okay, but what about a little Spice Girls? Is it going to kill them for a little Spice Girls?
Dave Shaw, what's your story?
A printer that can make a house.
Computer printer.
Sort of. It's a 3D printer instead of printer ink. It's got this concrete-like material. It was invented by a professor at the University of Southern California.
Wow. How much will that cost?
Given what printer ink will run you, I don't even want to know.
The radio show that Rico and Brendan do is called The Dinner Party. We've got a link to their podcast on our website. It's marketplace.org. And for right now, that's it. We got to go. Today, the Dow rose 0.2%, about 25 points. The NASDAQ perked up almost 0.5%, 14 points. The S&P 500 gained 0.2%, 2 points. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on Marketplace Money, New Orleans, 7 years later.
Financially, when the storm hit, no, I wasn't prepared. I don't think anyone was. The life of a musician is not easy. And the truth of the matter is I really didn't know what was going to happen next.
A story of survival and financial recovery. We are back here on Monday. Have yourself a great weekend. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.